Collins performs at the Egyptian Theater this Thursday through Saturday. And we had a chance to catch up with her in a pre-recorded interview on Friday. Let's have a listen. Grammy-winning folk music revivalist Judy Collins is coming to the Park City Egyptian Theater Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. She promises a different show each day. She's writing songs and books, collaborating in duets, and still performing more than 100 shows a year. Welcome, Judy Collins.
Thank you so much.
You have been doing this for better than 50 years. You sort of emerged from the folk revival timeframe of the 50s and early 60s, and you started to sing traditional folk songs during that time. How have things changed? Where have you evolved to at this point after this many years of performing for the world, really?
Well, let's start with today, and then I'll go back. Today, I do about 130 shows a year. I've been out with Stephen Stills doing a duet for the past year, and at the end of this year, I will have done about 115 shows with him. But all the other shows involve solo performances all over the world. And, of course, I make records. I do television shows. I write poetry. I've written 10 books, the last of which is called, or the most recent, is called Cravings, which is the story of my eating disorder. And that takes me back to the beginnings of my career, which I've actually been doing this for 59 years. And in 1959, I jumped into the great folk scare with a guitar and a few folk songs and soon had a big career of a record contract with Elektra Records, the first stretch of that, which reached for 25 years. So I've had an incredibly diverse and exciting career.
Well, and it sounds like, just in looking through your bio, you started in Boulder, Colorado, when you decided to start singing at Michael's Pub, just trying to help the family out financially to make ends meet.
I didn't have a job, and I didn't have a real job. I was filing papers at the University of Colorado. My husband and I always call him my starter husband. My husband and I had no money. We had a new baby, and I had this job at the university. And he had he was in school, of course. He was in his graduate school. And so one day he said to me, "Why don't you get a job doing what you know how to do, which is sing?" Of course, I'd been singing, performing, studying, playing the piano, singing on my father's radio show, doing the school show, the opera choruses, the choirs, everything you can think of I had done. I was performing literally from the age of 4, so I was trained rather than raised.
What about the way your singing has changed, or the way you interact with your audience? I had an opportunity to listen to your release of Dreamers. The performance is so timely, and I think you have a different take on just what you're trying to convey there.
I was raised in an activist family, and my father was on the radio, and he spoke out on many issues. And so when I was completely ready for the 60s, because I was already thinking about the things that I wanted to do, like march against the war in Vietnam and go to Mississippi to register black voters and go to the trial of the Chicago 7 in 1968. I was ready. I was willing, or rather 69. I was ready and willing and able and did always things that had to do with activism. I wrote a lot of songs about issues, situations. When I was a UNICEF representative and went to the former Yugoslavia, I wrote a song about the landmine situation called Sarajevo. And I wrote songs about 9/11. I wrote songs about interesting Me Too situations. I wrote a song called Lily of the Valley, which I'll probably be singing there in Utah. It's about violence against women. And I have always been an activist. And I've been representatives of UNICEF, as I said. I've marched in Washington for women's rights. I've March for Civil Rights. I've appeared in I was arrested from the Capitol in Washington with an event against the war in Vietnam. I've always been in it, so to speak. So a couple of years ago, I saw a story about dreamers and about a young woman who was talking about her mother and how she knew that her mother was worried about her because she was a dreamer and she was thinking that she might get thrown out of the country. So Dreamers is my latest of many, many songs about the world and about what goes on around us. And I have found that singing Dreamers the past few months in this country has been a dynamic and extraordinary experience for me and for my audiences. And I will be singing it in Utah and Park City.
Talk to us a little bit about how you preserve your voice. You've had some surgery in the past, from what I read, but was that a time period where you were at risk of losing your voice?
Oh, yes, I had lost it. And my doctor said I had a hemangioma on the vocal cord, which is like a capillary that has burst. And I was told in 1977 that the only way I would ever sing again was if the surgery was positive outcome surgery rather than negative. Actually, it's the same surgery that Julie Andrews had, and she wasn't so lucky. But it was early, 77, and it was a new laser treatment. It was on my vocal cord because of the drinking, I think, and the bulimia, and, you know, all that riotous living, I suppose, that was going on. I've always been a pretty calm and not on the party scene person for the most of my life, even at the worst of my drinking. But I was fortunate because after that surgery in 1977, during which that whole year I had to cancel about 45 shows, I was kind of at the top of my career previous to my recovery. I did get sober in 1978, so I've had a sober life for 40 years, which makes a huge difference in everything.
You've had collaborations. You started off the conversation talking about the work with Stephen Stills and the tour that you're currently still working with. But you've also collaborated with people like Willie Nelson, Glenn Hanser, Jeff Bridges, and Jackson Browne.
I know. It's a handful of great guys. Oh, it was wonderful. I met up with a young singer named Ari Hess, with whom I formed a friendship and who has opened for me numerous times over the past 6 years. And Ari wrote a song called Strangers Again, and I said, I've got to record that with you, which we did. And then I said, I've got to get a bunch of guys to come on board and sing duets with me. It'll be such fun. So I called Michael McDonald and Willie Nelson, and Jeff Bridges was actually my first call because I knew him the longest and knew him from a movie called Riders about the story of some crooks in the West. So I knew Ari personally, and I knew Jeff Bridges, and then everybody else kind of rolled out. You know, Willie Nelson and Glenn Hansard, as you said, and Jackson, a wonderful fellow. And so I had this wonderful duet album called Strangers Again, and then Ari and I started writing songs together, which we're still doing, by the way, and our first album, called Silver Skies Blue, got him his first Grammy nomination and got me my first Grammy nomination in 40 years. I had many in the earlier years and a couple of Grammys, but I got a Grammy nomination between 40 years between, and I now hold the record of time between Grammy nominations. And I found out that Gloria Gaynor is the runner-up with 23 years. So I win.
Boy, that's some great competition. So Judy, tell us about just what your advice might be. You've had this creative, productive career. What kind of creative advice would you have for those of us who maybe don't sing or write or any of those things, but clearly you've pursued some amazing journeys here?
Well, my advice is to anybody who's creative, to never, ever stop writing, stop performing, stop creating. Whether you're a painter or a singer or a pottery maker or a weaver, just keep doing what you do, because the creative life is the only life to have, truly, honestly. It's the only way to live, And don't forget that the job of the artist is also to be one's own promoter. I think artists, well, nowadays people are smarter about that. Young people know that. I knew it from a young age because I was raised in a performer's family. So I knew that you take responsibility for doing your due diligence, your promotion, your interviews, the promoters, the people who stack your albums in the record stores. From the very beginning, I knew that I had a responsibility to show up, to do the press, to be part of the whole thing, not just getting out on the stage. And I think that's been a wonderfully important piece of my own journey.
Judy Collins will be performing at the Egyptian Theater Company on Main Street in Park City. Show start at 8. They'll run Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. Go to EgyptianTheaterCompany.org for tickets and information. Well, last week, severe storms were forecast for parts of Utah with the remnants of Tropical Storm Rosa, Hurricane Rosa, I'm not sure which one that was, but making its way up from Mexico. There were concerns about flash flooding, and the governor called up the National Guard to help respond to the potential of these disasters. And I have Tom Fisher, Brigadier General Tom Fisher, in the studio. He's not wearing his uniform. I'm sorry. I was going to post that, but he decided not to because he had meetings coming.
Yeah, Carolyn, I've got county meetings the rest of the day, so I've got to just be Tom today.
Okay.
after this interview.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what happened last week. It's not considered a deployment of sorts, but it's an action taken by on the governor's order.
Certainly. I mean, most times when people think of the National Guard being called up for a deployment, they think of some type of overseas operation or some national emergency that could come up. But, you know, one of the main purposes of the National Guard is to be an asset to the state when something is going wrong that our skills can be applied to. In this case, Utah County identified a big need in the coming rain after the Pole Creek fire. They knew that if significant rain fell, that they were going to have a problem with mudslides and with water coming down the canyon, and they wanted to deal with that. They didn't have the assets themselves to deal with that. So they started talking to the State Emergency Operations Center about what assets were available around the state to deal with that.
Okay. And how often do things like that happen in your experience?
You know, in Utah, it seems like there's some kind of emergency about once a year. But, you know, there's things going on all the time with different types of units that the Utah National Guard has. We have a specialized unit that does work around testing for chemicals or testing for different things that could be harmful to human health. And they're used on a regular basis. And there's those types of assets exist in each of our states. And they do that in order to have that asset available on a constant basis.
Okay. And when, I mean, in this case, it was the potential of flash flooding, runoff from some pretty, you know, bad fires that were going on this year, and just managing some of those, I guess, are they engineering kinds of issues? So do you identify certain skill sets and bring those people in because of their background and that kind of thing?
So we have a kind of a typical set of things that happen in a given year. Some of the catastrophic things that could happen would be like an earthquake, a large earthquake, which doesn't happen very often, hasn't happened while I've been in the National Guard here in Utah. But flooding and fires do happen every year. So we have set up our system within the National Guard so that we know what our assets are at all times, whether they be engineering assets or just people, in order to do certain jobs. And they are ready to do certain jobs, and we have them set up on a grid of things that we can just pull upon when the governor calls for certain things.
So when the governor calls, does he call you? Does his staff call you?
In theory, yes. So what really happens is that, you know, we're always working for the civilian authority in a local government when these types of things happen. So usually what happens is a request goes up from the local government to the state emergency operations center that works for the governor. And then we have liaisons within the state emergency operations center, and they'll be talking about that request and all the assets throughout the state, whether they be the Department of Transportation, ourselves, health departments, local public works departments, to see what would be the best thing to apply to that problem. And in this case, the National Guard was chosen.
I see. And so what would be the other comparable emergency responses? I mean, I guess like the firefighters and
absolutely.
Emergency
A lot of times, for instance, if it's a large fire, it could be simply cordoning off areas to help local law enforcement deal with issues of getting people in and out of an area for a fire. For flooding, it could be the same thing. But with flooding, it tends to be a little bit more engineering-centric. So we might we have a lot of assets available to fill sandbags, and we have people. And that's a big job for people. So sometimes we're called up to do that. That was part of what we were doing in this case. And then we also had about 30 pieces of engineering equipment that we had available to apply to this problem. So they called that up, and we did everything from digging trenches to building berms and putting out jersey barriers within those systems in order to kind of channel water and channel mud as it was coming down the canyon.
Hmm. And how many people were called up to participate?
Just 200 in this case. So some operators for that equipment, as well as a lot of folks to fill sandbags and kind of deliver some of that stuff around to different places and help neighborhoods place them so that they could protect their property.
So, like, what about the equipment operators? Are these people like yourself who have other jobs? Do they operate equipment in their jobs, or did they learn this through their training at the Guard?
It's the whole gamut of things. We have National Guardsmen that, for instance, could be a doctor in their full-time job and operate a piece of equipment in their military job.
Yeah.
And they run the gamut too. They can be full time in the National Guard, or they can be a part time National Guardsman like I am. So this was a mix, so depending on what we need, that's who we call. So in this case, the equipment operators quite often are part time equipment operators for the National Guard. They sometimes do it on their full time job too. They're very skilled at what they do, so that's what we called up in this case.
And so that kind of training, when you go monthly to do your obligatory training mm-hmm. at the Guard, are those the kind of things that happen there?
Yeah, for those types of units, so if it's an engineer unit that operates equipment, that's what they'll be doing. But we had soldiers from our engineer units, from our military police units, from our military intelligence units, all doing civic actions in this case, really just supporting whatever that local government and that incident commander needed our guardsmen to do.
Okay. And so when you have a call out to go and help other states, when does that happen, and how does that happen?
So one of the biggest last examples of that is when the flooding happened in Colorado a few years ago. We sent an engineer battalion headquarters as kind of a coordinating element for several engineer units. One of our engineer equipment units went in a logistics unit, and they operated there for a couple of months. Rebuilding a road between the valley and Estes Park in order to get traffic moving back and forth again to make sure that we were able to get folks to school and get commerce moving again.
Yeah. Now, Southern Utah is a whole different story, of course, because of the serious flash flooding dangers that occur throughout the entire region.
I Absolutely.
Mean, lots of canyons, people, traveling, wandering, hiking, canyoneering, that type of thing. How does the communication work when the Guard is called up and to go down into areas like that? And how do you manage the vast you know, stretch of area that you have to cover?
Well, again, you know, our main job when we're called up is to work for local authorities. So whoever the incident manager is, you know, in a county or a city where an incident is happening, that's who we work for. So they're the ones that are really keeping the general awareness of what's going on in an incident. And then they're just using us as an asset to plug into a problem. But, you know, there's other things that go on. I mean, for instance, there was a search and rescue of a rock climber a few weeks ago where one of our National Guard helicopters was called out to perform a rescue off of the side of a mountain of this person that was stuck and couldn't get up and couldn't get down. So very specialized in that case for that type of work, and our folks are very specially trained to do that. So pretty much in that situation, although there's a local incident commander for that helicopter going out and for that person, that National Guardsman to be dropped down to rescue somebody, we're in charge of that.
Right, right. Wow, that must have been quite an incident, huh?
Well, the person had been hanging on ropes for quite a long time, and we knew that we suspected that they would probably possibly lose some limbs if they didn't get rescued very quickly. So they were actually called out at night to do it and performed it in darkness.
Wow. Yeah. So what is that? It's like a couple of helicopters. You've got people on the ground below.
I'm sure that the local authorities had people both below and above the climber. And then the helicopter would then coordinate with those local authorities to perform the rescue out of the helicopter.
Boy, that's something else, huh? Hey, so let's talk about the Pole Creek fire, because that was a pretty big blaze going for quite some time, and the you know, the effects of that leave the soil very unstable. With even I've heard descriptions of like a slimy, sludgy, almost kind of effect. Did the crews that were working in that area run into issues like that?
Well, I think what their job was to prepare for that to happen, so that when those things when the mud or the silt or the water came down, that we were able to kind of channel it back to normal channels of water flow, instead of affecting streets or affecting homes or affecting a couple of larger public works items like a water tank. So really, we were more on the preparation side of that, although we did have some National Guardsmen around as the rain was coming and as some of the mud was coming down the canyon. And it sounds like the results of that is that most of the work that was done worked in protecting property. And that was the job of what we were doing.
That was the plan. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Tom. Anything else you want to add about?
Well, just, you know, putting on my Summit County manager hat, you know, there could be a time in the future where our Summit County has to call up the governor and the State Emergency Operations Center to ask for these types of resources, or to help us solve a problem of a natural disaster that we have. It hasn't happened while I've been here, and we'll knock on wood about that. But you know, I'm very happy that we have these kind of assets at the state level when these kinds of incidents come up.
Yeah. I guess if that happened, you'd be bossing yourself around.
Well, I would certainly be having my Summit County manager hat on, yeah, and not my National Guard hat. There's plenty of us out there to help
do
those jobs.
Plenty of brigadier generals we can call on.
Well, they don't necessarily need brigadier generals to fill sandbags, but okay, we can help pay the bills at the end of the day.
Well, thank you, Tom. Appreciate you coming by. That's Tom Fisher.
Thank you very much.
With the Utah National Guard.
Correct.
Thank you. You're listening to KPCW Local News Hour. I have Abby McNulty. She's the executive director of the Park City Education Foundation, and she's here to give us a monthly update. Thank you for coming in, Abby. Appreciate
Thanks for
that.
Having me.
October is Dyslexia Month.
Yes.
And there are some new, well, pseudo-new initiatives going on. Apparently, we've piloted a program, an early reading program, and it sounds like maybe we're taking it district-wide at this point. Why don't you start off and tell us a little bit about that?
So the program's actually in its third year, and it was born from something called the Dyslexia Initiative, which was a partnership with PC Reads, Park City School District, and the Park City Education Foundation. And what it did is it brought a structured literacy program to Park City schools, in the elementary schools, K through 3. And it started at McPolin in its pilot year. And last year it expanded to all the elementary schools, K to 2, and now it's in place K to 3. And it teaches kids how to read using a phonics-based program. So its education has shifted over the years in terms of like where, you know, how teachers are teaching kids to learn to read. And in the past, it's focused on this fluency effort, and it kind of left phonics behind. So if you're a struggling reader or a dyslexic student, you really need phonics. You need a really strong phonics foundation. And so this program is not only benefits dyslexic students and those who struggle with reading, but all students.
So for people who aren't familiar with the vernacular, phonics versus fluency, can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So phonics is the sounds that letters make when they come together. So like A, apple. And fluency is just like, and this is where I can't do it justice, but my understanding of fluency is more, you know, looking at like a whole sentence and like being able to identify apple. But dyslexic students, and I have a soft spot because I'm dyslexic and so is my daughter, can't read apple because they don't even know that A makes the sound ah and P makes the sound puh. So you have to teach the basics to these students before they can become fluent readers.
And was there a time period where the phonics portion was sort of abandoned as being required or needed?
I think and this is sort of like a bigger education conversation, but yes, in our education schools around the country and in practice in our elementary schools, there was a movement away from phonics towards fluency. And so then teachers weren't getting trained in how to teach phonics because it's a very specific, you know, skill and system. And it wasn't being implemented in the classroom. And that's happening all over the country. And so Park City School District is on the leading edge here in Utah in bringing this very structured literacy program to all of our elementary schools so that you have phonics instruction as a piece of the puzzle. It's not the entire puzzle, but it's a very important piece.
So also I know that this year we've added some interventionist assistance in all of our elementary schools. Is that also part of that effort?
The school district added last year to the budget the funding to have two interventionists at every elementary school. And they're all complementing each other because it's really important. Kids need to learn to read by grade 3 because that a shift takes place. You're no longer learning to read. You're reading to learn. And so if any student isn't reading on grade level by grade 3, they're then always going to be playing catch up. So the earliest you can intervene, the better for a student, the better for our community. All different kinds of reasons.
Yeah, sure. We do have some transients in our community. We have a lot of families coming and going. And so you bring in, say, a second grader who is not on target.
Yeah.
What does it take to get that child ready by third or fourth grade to be reading to learn? What does it take?
Yeah, that is a great question and one that an educator would have to answer. So I'm just a, you know, nonprofit person.
Not just.
You know, and that's the work that they do. I mean, that's the work that all of our teachers do every day is to, you know, take the 20 to 25 kids in their classroom and make sure that they're all, you know, having growth and attaining the material that they need to.
So the individual progress is part of that also.
100%. It's all based on individual progress. Like I just had a parent-teacher conference with my daughter's teacher. She's in second grade. And, you know, they talked about what I can expect in terms of growth from her this year. And so everything is about individualizing for the student.
Sure. And so with Dyslexia Month, October, how do we know if our child is dyslexic?
That's a great question. So part of the dyslexia initiative is PC Reads trains, goes to every school to talk to teachers about what it is like to be dyslexic and also talking about the characteristics of dyslexia. And what this program has done, it's called Wilson Foundations, is the structured literacy curriculum that has been implemented. It also makes it really obvious to see where students have gaps. And so teachers cannot diagnose dyslexia, you know, an outside diagnosis has to take place, but it's obvious if a student is struggling on certain areas that they have some sort of reading challenge. And this program has brought that to surface.
Okay.
And that is how my daughter was identified, okay. is that she was struggling based on this very structured literacy program. You know, things weren't clicking. You know, this is back in kindergarten.
Yeah, yeah. So, and Wilson Foundations is a program we've brought in. It's probably been here, what, 3 or 4 years?
This is its third year.
Okay, mm-hmm. okay.
Yeah.
So the issue of adults who have dyslexia.
Yeah.
Are they part of Dyslexia Month, or is it all about students? I mean, can adults be treated or
yeah, well,
practical things?
Sure. I mean, for the Park City Education Foundation, you know, Dyslexia Awareness Month is about thinking about the programs that we are helping support and bringing to the schools. But as someone who is dyslexic myself and everyone in my family is dyslexic, you know, it's interesting conversations to have. A lot of adults discover their dyslexia through their kids' journey, which is super interesting. Mm-hmm. And so as you know, PC Reads, which is an organization that advocates for dyslexia for students, as they do their work and as they gather more momentum and more conversations are taking place, I think more people, adults, will say, hey, that sounds super familiar. I've had those similar struggles. Like, you know, maybe I'm dyslexic too.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, there's also the One Book, One Community
yes.
program. Let's talk a little bit about
yep.
that.
So Cameron Wright, he's the author of The Rent Collector. He is the selected author for One Book, One Community this year. And he is coming to Park City on October 16th and 17th. And both those days, he will be working at Park City High School with students, lecturing and also working in small groups with identified classes. And then on Wednesday, October 17th, he will be doing a free community conversation at the Jim Santee Auditorium at 7 to 8:30 p.m. And it, yeah.
And he'll be talking about his book, The Rent Collector.
He'll be talking about his book, The Rent Collector.
And is that a read for kind of young adults?
Yes.
Adolescents?
Yes.
What's the age range?
Yeah. I think it's in a book that's probably appropriate for young adults, teens, all the way up to, you know, us.
So, all the way up.
You know, I don't want to say how
not
old
that,
we are,
not
but.
Not that far. Not that far up. So was this required reading for students over the summer?
Yeah, it's optional reading for students. It's called One Book, One Community so that the entire high school has the opportunity to read it this fall. And then the community is also encouraged to read it so that we can all have a common conversation. And the beauty of it is it's actually a book selected by the Park City English Department because they're looking for books that are going to be the best fit for their students. And then we then partner the Education Foundation, the high school, the libraries, and Dolly's Bookstore to make sure that everyone in the community is involved.
Great, great. What other big efforts? I know master planning is starting with our district-wide effort. It's been in the works now for quite a number of months, and there's a committee in place. Where does the Ed Foundation fall into this? Do you have a seat at the committee? Are you part of the public input? Where do y'all come in there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are a part of the public process. And I know that, so the Education Foundation has 20 two board members, and our board members are encouraged to participate in, they're doing an education summit, which I think several, and then that will break down into smaller groups to focus on certain areas. We're hoping to have representation there. And then also we do have a board member that sits on the committee as well.
Okay. Great. Anything else, Abby?
No, thank you for having me today. I'm so happy to see the snow, and I hope everyone goes out to read The Rent Collector.
Thank you. I think I'm going to put it on my list. Yeah. I don't know if I'll get it done by next week, but it sounds great. Thank you for coming in. That's Abby McNulty. She's the executive director of the Park City Education Foundation. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Good morning. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. My next guests are Carol Levine and Sue DeMartini. They're both from the Newcomers Club here in Park City, and there is an event. Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Carol, tell us a little bit about this fair that's coming up.
Well, they did this fair. The Newcomers did this fair 3 years ago, so we felt it was time to do another one. And it was a very interesting process because Park City has so many nonprofits that it's difficult to choose. But we tried to get newer ones that have not been out there. But then we also took the old, you know, like Christian Center, Peace House, and all that. And it's been a wonderful experience for me because meeting nice people. And this fair is going to be at the community church on Wednesday from 10 to 12.
And what can people expect?
This is Sue. What we're doing is having the nonprofits come and discuss with both newcomers and the community itself. We've invited the outside community to attend this meeting, and it's an opportunity to learn about living and contributing in Park City. We have a very active group. Our members are, some are retired and some have just chosen to come here and start their lives again in Park City. And this is such an active community that it's a wonderful opportunity for people to find ways they can contribute and volunteer their time.
Yeah. What a great idea. What a great way for people to get accustomed to our town here.
Exactly.
And the area. So what are going to be some of the booths that are there or the representation that's there?
Okay. Well, I have a list right here. We have over 20, probably 25. We've tried to keep it to 20.
Just give us a few
samples. I just couldn't say no. Okay. The big ones that everyone knows are Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Christian Center. Connect is a new one. It's, I think, about 2 years old, and that deals with mental health. Elmer's Helpers is a new one, and they provide for the schools products that they need. The National Ability Center, Park City Tots, PC Reads, Park City Community Foundation, Utah 1033 Foundation. They're out of Salt Lake, but this is for the fallen officers. It's an amazing organization. And one of my favorites that I just started volunteering for is Bright Futures. And this comes from the Park City Education Foundation. And this is to get local students into college.
Yeah, first generation.
First generation. Yeah, thank you. I couldn't get that out.
No, they're doing quite a lot of great work in the schools right now.
They are. They're
providing
wonderful.
Those opportunities. Yeah. Well, are there any other events, Sue, that are coming up with the Newcomers Club that you want to mention?
Well, this is our big focus right now. We're really anxious to have people attend. We've put flyers all through the community, and we're hoping to have some follow-up with your station. And what do we have coming up? We have Christmas time, we have a wonderful group who comes in, and they're
Treble Makers.
Treble Makers.
Oh, yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
And that's one of our regular things. Yeah. Who else, Carol?
We have the curator from the Museum of Contemporary Art coming to speak, and then the week after, there's a group going to the museum. So we have that. We have next month, we have Katie Lang from Park City Film coming to speak. So our meetings are great. They're the second Wednesday of every month, And that's open to the public, too.
Exactly.
And we have the ladies cook and bake, and it's very nice. Nice refreshments.
Great. Do you meet in the same place every time?
The community church.
Yes,
always the community church. And it's the second Wednesday. What time is that usually?
That's the 10 to 12.
Okay. Same time frame then.
Same time.
10 to 12. You just keep it that way.
Right.
Okay. Well, great. If there's more information, somebody wants to find out about the Newcomers Club, where would they go?
Right online. They could go look at the Newcomers of Greater Park City, click on the newsletter, and you'll see what's going on for the whole month.
Okay.
And maybe they'd like to join the newcomers. You don't have to be new in town to be a newcomer.
Oh, okay.
There are people there for 20 years, and I'll probably be one of them if I last that long.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's Carol Levine and Sue DiMartini from the Park City Newcomers Club.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.